Hi, I'm Katrina Bronson, the writer-director of Daltrey Calhoun.
And I'm Danielle Renfrew, the producer.
And I'm Quentin Tarantino, the executive producer of Daltrey Calhoun.
And here's our Kids in America song that opens a movie.
I think this is like 2001. I always thought, it was a bone.
Mm-hmm. So this is our highly stylized opening prologue sequence.
Now,
I like to call it.
Now, all through the editing, it was the song was "Mickey" by Tony Basil. How did it get changed to "Kids in America" by Kim Wilde?
I thought that "Mickey" was overdone, and I thought I was making a cool switch. And of course, I'm doubting myself as we sit here today.
There were so many great songs. So we had Duran Duran in there for a while. It was fun.
Well, I wrote the whole script to music, so music is a very important part of the.
And Elizabeth Banks.
Johnny Knoxville.
Yes, I was going to say she did have a day of roller skating practice to prepare for.
This is my favorite part. One of my favorite parts: the cannabis plants. Mm-hmm. The placement of the cannabis plants.
And this was all shot, the film was shot anamorphically. This was not, and this was all handheld. So it was done specifically to really set apart from the rest of the movie. And you'll see that we did a bleach bypass, so the colors are really desaturated. And
so this is also your first day of a first feature film, and they schedule me with babies and dogs and handheld. So that was a blast for the first 2 days.
Well, we had to jump in.
She's awesome. Amazing, amazing character actress. Just came to her audition in that wig.
And we had her bring it with her down to Tennessee.
Oh, her Tammy Wynette
wig. That's her wig,
She is so talented, and I see her everywhere now. Now that I know her, like, she works nonstop in TV and film. But this is a difference of shooting in Tennessee versus L.A. Like, this house, we paid for it by giving them that cement slab in front that Elizabeth was roller skating on. That was their payment for us using their house for 2 days.
Oh, you paved over their dirt lawn.
Exactly.
And
their dirt lawn.
They were really excited. I think we gave them a couple $100 or something. But people were way more open to it and excited about it than when you location scout in L.A. and everybody's very jaded and wants to know how much money they're going to make.
So that wasn't there before?
No.
That's how we paid for the location.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So. And that baby was actually the niece of one of our, head of our transpo department. And they were twins, but such cute little babies.
We're not happy to
be in that crib, though. We're not happy. They kept trying to escape. We had to keep calling cut because they would be crawling under the crib.
Wasn't there a story about, like, you making the kid cry?
Well, Katrina's a cruel and unusual woman.
Yeah, I mean, the kid was supposed to be in distress, obviously, because of the parents biting everything. It didn't take a lot to make the kid cry. It was it took a lot to keep the kid in the playpen because she could climb out very easily. So in between takes, Johnny would run over and put the kid back in, and it was a
But we usually always had, like, the kid's mom or grandma right near the crib, and you'll see at some points when the baby's yelling "Nana, Nana," and it kind of blends in. But Nana was right by the camera.
when the little baby's going "Mama, Mama," it's not acting.
No,
all right? it's
"Mama,
Mom,
save me!" Right,
get me away from these screaming people.
Oh, and that poor chicken. Oh, it almost went, but
no chickens were harmed.
Yes.
We have our humane seal of approval.
Right. Like in Kill Bill, though, if you're going to harm a chicken, do it in Mexico.
There you go.
good piece of advice, yes.
I can't believe you made it. He doesn't like it.
My first memory is of my father's departure.
So this is Sophie Traub's narration, June's narration, coming up right now.
We have some great beauty shots coming up. I mean, shooting in Tennessee, we really wanted to take advantage of how beautiful it was, and I think this opening title sequence really shows that.
And our Lee Hazelwood song to hear right now. This is I think, such a cool song and very appropriate to what's happening.
Oh, it's true.
Narratively.
No, actually, I had, when I saw the film finished, I actually hadn't heard it with this song. And the first time I saw it,
yeah.
with I'm a big Lee Hazelwood fan. When I saw it with this music, I was like, oh, my God, that's terrific.
That's right. We switched that.
It was a last-minute addition. Thanks very much to our music supervisors, mm-hmm. Howard Parr and Anastasia Brown, mm-hmm. who dug up some really awesome music.
Music supervisor is extraordinary.
Andrew Prime.
There you go.
My man,
yes.
Andrew Prime.
James Parks, Matthew Sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Well, more about them when we get to that.
More
yes. Casting directors. And these are actually shots of Oaklawn, the house that you'll see more in the movie, but this was our main location, which was the hugest coup for us. We not only found a beautiful house, but a great man who kind of became our Tennessee godfather of the project, Ron Schaff.
And George Jones and Tammy Wynette formerly lived in the house, so that was just another added...
How cool is that?
Yeah. And this sign, the Flick sign, we could only afford to, that's really Ted's Sporting Goods. We could only afford to do one side of the sign. So hence we shoot only that side of the store.
That was the big budget for signage.
Right? Exactly.
Flicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We always joke we gave you the really, like, hardcore card.
Yeah.
The Gestapo.
I know. Yeah. Exactly.
See, this is also
shooting
in
Colombia. Right. The font started looking a little Nazi-ish, all right?
Well, it's funny because we weren't, you know, the country shots we were always thinking could maybe be cool for the opening credit sequence, but these town ones we never were thinking. They were always setting up for another shot. So you'll see the camera slightly moving and us, like, focusing, but they worked well.
So this is the... This is the commercial, and I'm very, very proud of the commercial, which I
now
wrote myself.
Now let me ask another question.
Yeah.
Why did you decide? Because I've seen this many different versions of this. All right, mm-hmm. full screen, letterbox screen,
mm-hmm.
and now it's done as source with a little bit of a coffee cup right there. Mm-hmm. Why did you finally decide to make?
Because I wanted to establish that we were in this diner and that we were watching. As you'll see when we go around to the next shot and meet Wanda Banks, Laura Cayouette. Who's interviewing Johnny, I wanted to establish that we were in the store and they were actually watching
right.
the commercial there, in the diner, rather. So this is Laura Cayouette as Wanda Banks.
Mm-hmm. Laura was in, Laura's a friend of mine, she was in Kill Bill playing Rocket.
Yes.
And definitely we, the costume designer for this, we used Nicole Kidman in To Die For as kind of an aesthetic, and I mean, she looked so great.
She definitely has her fuzzy charm going on in that suit.
I love this guy. If you look straight down the middle, this is one of my favorite guys. And if you look carefully,
in the overalls?
He's used many times as an extra.
Yeah. The guy in the overalls, like chewing tobacco.
Exactly.
Yeah, that
right
guy.
There,
yeah, there
down
he
the
is.
Looking straight down the barrel.
Looking right
by the
down
way.
The barrel of the camera. Yeah.
But you'll see him.
Well, there is a camera
exactly,
there.
Exactly. Right.
So. Yes.
Yeah, so, and we went back to Columbia recently to do the end credit music video for the things, and they had kept Charlie Gunn's eatery sign in the window.
Mm.
So right now, a year later, it's still Charlie Gunn's eatery.
Well, maybe a stop on the U.S. Open.
Ducktown was an enchanting town. I felt as though I'd been dropped on my ass into a whimsical town of a bygone era.
So this is where June and her mother come back, 14 years later, come back into Daltrey's life.
Daltrey had transformed his talent for creating cannabis seed hybrids and his passion for golf.
Troll.
Yes, his
that
name is Troll.
That man wrote a book, and I have read it.
So this...
This is David Koechner right here.
And all of that artwork, it was all artwork that was in the diner that we put up by local artists. I love the folk art in there. So this was a scene that we worked on and kind of reworked and ended up using a lot of voiceover from Sophie Traub, which really was, she was so great to work with. And we flew her in from Canada to do voiceover for 2 days for her first movie. It was pretty... exciting,
but she'd grown an inch since we saw her the last time.
And Katrina was rewriting until the moment she got there, but she totally rolled with the punches.
Well, it definitely is a plus when you're the, when you're a writer director and you've set up voiceover narration that anything doesn't quite work out in the editing room.
Okay, I can fix that.
Yes. Yeah. So this is
magical Sophie, I call her, because I just think she's this lovely magical human being and actress, and she we had this random tape came in, and we ran this up to you, and and you said get on a plane and go find this girl. We'd seen, I think, a couple hundred girls all over, and right fell in love with her.
All right, stop playing now. Say hello to Mr. Calhoun.
So it's been noted that June and you are similar to in certain areas and stuff. What would you say about that?
I would agree. It's a little sad, you know, because I think you're talking about present day. Me and woman in my mid-30s is similar to June and 14. But no, June, yeah, we had a lot of similarities.
We see where the tree became.
Yes. But, you know, Sophie actually is a lot like June. I mean, really, you know, a pretty serious student or reader, kind of lost in the world of books as a child, and yeah, that was definitely me, a late bloomer. I mean, my 14-year-old peers at the time, you know, boyfriends, this and that, and that was not me, nor Sophie in real life. Sophie, I'm sorry. Is that okay to say?
but now, you know, since you've walked a mile in her mucky high tops, all right, then how was that like directing a character that is very, that's, you know, especially when she was 14, is very autobiographical on your own experiences?
Well, it just having the insight and you know, having, being able to, Sophie knew that was me. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't afraid to kind of make a fool of herself or be a dork. And in scenes, and some of the deleted scenes of the just and the stomping off and the 14, I mean, I would do that for her. I'd be like, you know, it's like this. And so when she'd see me make a fool of myself, and no, she's like, okay, we're the same. We know. So did that make sense?
That makes all the sense, yeah.
Well, when Sophie,
this is the hardest scene, I think, for the actors in terms of it was shot out of context and pickups within the scene and... you know, so here's our Oaklawn, beautiful Oaklawn exterior.
Yeah, this is Daltrey's estate, which
a
good 40% of the movie takes place in.
Yes.
But by the time we caught up with him, Calhoun Industries was secretly teetering on the brink of collapse.
Well, one of the things when I visited the set was Daltrey's house was a former plantation. And y'all told me, oh, and there's even a slave quarters in the place. And I go, really? There's a slave quarters? I've actually never been in a... Not only had I never been in a plantation before, I've definitely never been in the former slave quarters before. So that grabbed my attention right away. That's like, this is what I wanted to see. So I went down. So while you guys were shooting, I found out where the room was, and I went down there, and there was all these, you know, stones, and you know where obviously the beds used to be and where the fireplace was, all made up of this, like, these stone rocks, and the place was fascinating, and I was actually just hanging out down there. For any time I would get bored on the set, I'd just go down there and just, you know, commiserate with the ghost. And I thought, well, how can you shoot in this place that has this intense room and not do something with it? It's really cool. So I suggested to you that you should write a scene that takes place in the slave quarters and you know, refer to it. And then I left. and you did. And it didn't make the cut. How come?
Well, I wrote the scene, and we shot the scene. And I don't think I pulled the scene off. I don't think I pulled off the intent of the scene. I agree with you, you know, the energy of the room and all of that, and I think that that's a separate movie. Mm-hmm.
Eugene and Arlo.
Tell us
about these guys. Matthew Sharp and James Parks, and these guys are... amazing. You probably recognize them.
From Kill Bill. Well, James Parks from Kill Bill, yeah, among other things. So awesome.
Yeah. And these are Daltrey's business associates.
James Parks is the son of the terrific actor Michael Parks.
Michael Parks, yeah.
He's just one of my favorite actors. He used to be on the TV show, then came Bronson, and I've used him playing the character of Texas Ranger Earl McGraw twice. Once in Dust Till Dawn, and then second time in Kill Bill Volume 2, which Jimmy's in as well, playing his son, Edgar McGraw, who's in two movies of mine, Dust Till Dawn 2 and Kill Bill Volume 1. And Michael Parks also played the character Esteban Vallejo, the Mexican bordello operator in Kill Bill Volume 2, and gives one of the best performances of any of my movies in that role.
Calhoun Industries. Welcome. Okay. Long trip from Palm Springs, California.
And this is an Australian actor, Kick Gurry, who has come to town to, he's the renegade solution, basically, to all of Daltrey's problems, and becomes June's love interest.
And how did you find him?
He wrote me a letter. He read the script, and he wrote a letter, and I filed the letter. I kind of just saved all the stuff that had come in. He's like, oh, you know, this part for an Australian actor, it would be a dream come true. But that part was taken, so I saved the letter. And we came back to him.
Now, on the outside of this story is... Edgar P. Poole's...
I stole that.
All right, yeah, that's...
Right from under you.
Yes.
But I warned you I was going to.
No, you did. That's a character that's been in, like, two scripts I've never finished. All right? Usually the autobiographical
stand-in. Do you want to say what your P stands for?
Yeah, Poncho.
Yes. And
cool. Edgar Poncho Poole.
Yeah.
And, yes, I've written two scripts I haven't finished. Mm-hmm. I've written even a book. All right, one chapter of a book.
It's
the thing about it, I didn't even realize, even I knew you put it in, but until I was actually sitting in a movie theater.
I was like, you know, there's going to be this picture window shot that
comes. No, I knew that. But when I was sitting in this movie theater watching the film with an audience on the screen, all of a sudden it hit me. It was like, wait a minute. That guy is Edgar Poncho Poole. The old guy is Edgar. That's like...
I told you.
All right.
But in his cool,
I'm going to grow up
cool
and be... And he's cool, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it still kind of bothers me that...
No.
She, no. It bothers me that she rips off the posters.
Oh.
Yes.
You know, and you're not the... It's interesting because Ron Schaff, again, somebody else noticed that. And, mm-hmm. and that's why we added in... it's actually our editor, Dan Padgett's doing that voice because we couldn't afford to have the real guy speak. Mm-hmm. He says, come back, little girl, you didn't pay. But mm-hmm. that was sort of to calm down you. And a couple of other people were like, she steals it.
It doesn't make me feel any better that she's he's yelling after her.
But she's really, it's not her intent to, she's just so caught up in, okay.
Well, she seems to be around all the time, so she must have paid him back. All right.
Yes.
She's always hanging around in front of the store.
And that's her, I mean, June's a musician, so Edgar P. Poole's, that's her hangout. Like, that would be...
I would think.
Her life when we're not with her, that's where she is.
Well, you're not a priest, Daltrey.
Look. For the part of Flora, I mean, because of how this whole movie came about, we were lucky enough to basically be able to cast anybody that we wanted, unknowns, et cetera, and had seen a bunch of people, and... I said to Quentin, what do you think about Juliet? And he, from that point on, was like, if she'll do it, I mean, there's no need to look elsewhere. She's mm-hmm. so good that she can pull off anything and just make it amazing. And the thing is that she, you know, having her do Flora was something kind of different for her, and have the softness come out, and she just really jumped in and embraced it and was happy to kind of play with the softer, flirty side of Juliet.
I need to talk to you about something important.
What?
It's a couple things, really.
This was one of the biggest surprises of Juliet Lewis's performance from script to screen. Mm-hmm. Because I always liked the Flora character in the script, but I didn't love the Flora character.
in the script. I thought she was, you know, she was doing her job and the thing, whatever. And but Juliet Lewis just took the character.
Well,
and
Julia, I mean, she's like, you didn't want to call cut because you want to see what she's going to do.
Look at that sky. I mean, that's a Tennessee sky.
There's Kick.
This song.
So this is the song. This song in itself is a whole story, but basically our soundtrack, I think we're the only film to have Serge Gainsbourg and Johnny Cash on one soundtrack, and a lot of it is due to letter-writing campaigns and just stopping at nothing to
begging,
like, this
bad French
song was
actually
going to be in this movie.
You know what, actually, why don't you actually expand on that a little bit, because you know, a lot of people, when they're doing a film and they don't have that much money and everything, they just assume they can't afford this or afford that. And so sometimes they don't even try. And plus, even if you want to try, you have all these other people working with you that are saying, oh, don't even try.
Exactly. Well, the thing is everybody had warned me. Like I said, I wrote the script to music. And June, as her character as a musician, is a very important part of the movie. And everybody, including you, I believe, had warned me, don't fall in love with your temp music. Don't fall in love with your temp music. But basically, we put in, you know, everything, a wish list kind of music. And this is one of the things. It's like, why not? What do you have to lose? And I just called, went through everything, told everybody I know. Does anybody know anybody who knows anybody who knows any, you know, 100 people removed from someone? And meanwhile, this was me privately. Then you have the music company dealing with, like, French Universal, you know, trying to work that in. And so I wrote a letter to the widow of the Gainsbourg estate, Bamboo, and there's a whole story of how I even got to her, which was a tremendous story in and of itself. But finally had the information to write her a letter and sent her this clip and basically wrote a letter to trying to save my life to get this song. And we kept hearing back and forth, okay, it looks good, okay, no, okay, they already gave the rights, but that doesn't matter because Universal wouldn't. And then, you know, there were many people, like, who had to sign off on it. And it was just and we held this, we in the final mixing, this was at the 11th hour, Danielle was actually in a booth trying to get you on the phone, I think. And it was like, we finally got our yes, we got it. We really got it signed off. We're not going to get sued if we put it in. And it was, okay, we can mix it. It was the last thing mixed in the whole movie.
I would just say at the end of the day, it was really about determination. And I think
tenacity.
That,
yeah. That's right.
And
here.
Everybody was not, I mean, that song had to be in the movie. And also, you know, there's creative solutions if need be, you know. If you really want to make it happen, you can ask them to do, you know, deals, maybe do what are called step deals and pay a little bit up front. But if you, we just wouldn't take no for an answer. And I think finally, you know.
I mean, it is. Like, there's a fine line between, and I'm talking about just in the making of this movie, of us, of driving somebody absolutely crazy and being tenacious and being respectful. But, like, this, you know, making a movie no matter what.
Right, exactly. Anyway, I mean, and the thing that was so funny, though, is the song thing really goes a long way, because it is a situation that a lot of, you know, filmmakers find themselves in, especially when they're trying to make something low budget and everything. And you know, everything out there is going to be no, but you gotta not take no for an answer.
I mean, that's kind of, it's like a cliche for a reason, that don't take no for an answer, because it's really true.
Right.
And you have nothing to lose. It's like, this is your, well, for me, child at that point, like, whatever, here, I'm wide open, I will make myself as vulnerable as possible to get what I need.
And what was so kind of like the phony Victoria bitter bottle there,
they wouldn't give us clearance because of minor, the real Victoria bitter wouldn't give us clearance because of minor drinking in
the
movie.
Yeah,
but
right,
Tracy Gallagher once again did an amazing job with our dummy labels.
What are the initials on it if it's not VB?
I think it's BT if I remember correctly.
But one of the things is, was a crack up was the fact that, at the finish on the song thing is at the, premiere, I bump into no less than, Pat Lucas.
Did she tell you I wrote a letter to her?
Yes. And Pat Lucas was the woman who had the power of the pen at EMI when I did Reservoir Dogs. And I absolutely needed to have a Stuck in the Middle with You.
in the film that I actually needed to actually film to.
Yeah.
And we had a $15,000 for a music budget.
Wow.
And it all went to Stuck in the Middle, which actually was even kind of a low price even then for a song that was well known, that was featured as heavily as it was. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that that happened was because I had some different friends of Karen Rackman and Stacey Scher, mm-hmm. who was one of the producers on millions of movies now, but that time, Fisher King, knew Pat Lucas, wrote these blowjob letters about me. All right.
Excellent term.
Yeah, perfect. You know, that's the blowjob letter. All right. Wrote these great blowjob letters about me. There even was a day that Pat Lucas, Karen Rackman, brought Pat Lucas to the set.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
And we treated her like she was like this visiting royalty, yeah. this visiting queen and everything, all to get her to like, okay, I'm going to give you our song for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And she did.
Mm-hmm.
And supported us all the way from then on there, and it was just so great to see her at the at the Daltrey premiere doing it, you know, doing it all over
again.
Absolutely.
Well, she set the. I think she was the first person, correct me if I'm wrong, business wise, who enabled us to, for the songs other than Je T'aime. That I mean, mm-hmm. she's really set the standard for us.
We don't want to get her fired or anything.
Oh, sorry.
But she was very helpful.
She's a good friend in court.
Yes, and
we love Pat Lucas.
Yes. So this was actually...
Shirley, I love Shirley. Yes, my favorite extra in the movie.
Yes, we love her. This was actually really interesting. This scene in the script came much earlier, and it was never working there.
Andrew Prine. Mm-hmm. I have to take credit for tenacity by insisting that Andrew Prine's speech, you know, not be left out of inattention.
But it actually worked so much better here attached to that demonstration. But it was one of those things Katrina and I, you know, were blurry-eyed, I think, from being in the edit room. And Quentin came in and said, hey, had you ever thought about moving that just after that? And it worked so well, but it was one of those things.
Yeah, these are two different parties in the actual movie, you know, before, not in the actual movie, in the script.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Two separate events.
And in very different parts of the film, but I think this works really well. And without having Andrew Prine here, it was harder to set up how important Daltrey really was to the town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's exactly what he accomplishes here.
Yeah, that was one of my feelings, was the fact that by having a town character that's important, like the sheriff,
mm-hmm.
actually have some lines, refer to Daltrey, we get to know a little bit of Daltrey's past as far as the town is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to meet anybody else from the town. We feel like we've met the town through Andrew Prine.
A lot of people depended on Daltrey. But no one looked up to him more than Doyle.
This is David Koechner.
And this I actually really love. This was one of the first pieces our composer made. And I think it's before he was even officially on the movie. He saw a cut of the movie and gave this to Katrina, this one little piece, and we loved it so much.
John
Swihart, who's really, we were really lucky to have him.
One of my favorite line readings of... this one.
Yeah. No.
That's a laugh.
Oh, no. In my tour of movie theaters, when it was playing, it always got a laugh. You can always guarantee that yes, no, only we get a laugh.
Yeah.
You do a real nice job watering these flowers.
This, for some reason, was one of the hardest locations for us to secure. It was actually a home of this couple that was, you know, not into letting us shoot here at all. And Katrina and Matt Irving, our wonderful DP, just fell in love with the Rolling Hills and thought it was so hilarious because it was kind of like a pseudo golf course. So again, we were very tenacious and kept knocking on their door saying, hey, have you rethought it? Do you think maybe we won't have to go in the house? They finally let us shoot there. But
here's Johnny using his left-handed signature. Mm-hmm. He had to learn to do everything left-handed. So if we'd grab a meal out after mm-hmm. shooting, and he'd be, you know, like, put your fork in your left hand.
While also trying to right ancient wrongs of family history.
You love that bloodletting line.
Yeah. I was laughing at the ancient wrongs of family history.
It's June, she's 14, she gets very dramatic about her.
Yes, no, she's...
Everything is very important.
Her narration is very, very much how I grew up to write the novel narration.
I want everyone to know that June is my daughter.
Well, that's what you want. But I don't know if it's right for her yet.
And I want to know what happened all those years.
I think this is a very pretty scene of Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
It's like she looks like a 1940s movie star. Mm-hmm.
This is a hard one for me to watch because of the, I'm going to say because it is the DVD talking, but like cigarette continuity and stuff. I did not look at it that way.
Oh, I've never paid attention to stuff like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, and here he's talking about, you know, wanting people to know about his daughter, and that really ties into Johnny Knoxville, the man, because I think in real life, you know, him being a father is one of the most important things to him and a big reason of why he did this movie and why he really connected to the script.
Mm-hmm. This is actually my favorite scene of Elizabeth Banks is in the film. She kind of has...
Me too.
She has a cool kind of like kind of barfly quality about her.
Mm-hmm. This is, this has the same bleach bypass that the prologue of the film had. Our flashbacks were all treated the same way. So they're distinctly set apart from the rest of the movie, hopefully.
It was like golf became his religion. And the course became sacrosanct.
Now this kind of bums me out because I wanted you to be able to read the title of that book, which is The Joy of Sex. but unfortunately, I don't think you can make it out.
And that was, I mean, again, I can't say enough good things about Tracy Gallagher, our production designer, because we had no money. This was like a location that we were actually thinking of just cutting and only shooting interior. But that little cabin, which you'll see the inside of, you know, was totally a raw space. It was white, you know, plastic siding, you know, that just had equipment in it. And she really made it seem like a sweet little cabin.
I sing to him. Go to sleep. Go to
but sleep. Things like, I mean, this location, being on this pond, I mean, it's priceless.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of strange that almost all this stuff was right there on the property.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'd literally show up and like, okay, we're going to shoot west today. We're going to shoot east.
Well, you'll also see, I mean, so one of the things here, too, with all of our exteriors is we were shooting in the fall, and the seasons were changing right before our eyes. So you'll see, I mean, the weather continuity, and you never knew, like, was it going to, like, this scene we kept putting off because every day we went to shoot it, it started raining. But but it was a real challenge shooting in the South at that time of year because of weather. But then there's just a texture to this place and, you know, actually shooting in Tennessee that was priceless.
Can you read anything?
It's a Marty Robbins song here that I just love. Utah Carol, it's called, which will come back at the end in a Wu-Tang Marty Robbins mashup. Yes. And now this is Sophie, again, she had to learn everything left-handed as well. So the outtakes from this scene, as you can imagine, are pretty funny. She's...
which I believe are on the DVD.
Yes, they are on the DVD. Yeah. She's not left-handed. And this is kind of, I love this scene. This is where she talks about her whole philosophy of music.
No, this is actually my favorite scene in the film. It was my favorite scene in the script, too.
Cool.
Tammy Wynette and Missy Elliott, same. George Jones and Method Man, same.
I didn't know
not
you...
Not a whole hell lot of difference between a cowboy bandit and an OG, except for that an OG... Original gangsta. You want to play with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So the object is to catch the ball before it hits the ground.
I love that he wears his cell phone on his belt.
Big business going on. A lot's at stake.
Yeah, that's a way to look busy in a small town.
I know.
So what?
Yeah, so what?
And right there.
Uh-oh,
right?
Something's about to happen. Yeah. And that was the original. Right. That was the original crow.
And if you look closely, all those guys were the same guys that were in Charlie Guns.
Don't look too closely. This day was practically freezing. This is one of those.
Smoke was coming out of people's mouths.
Well, you're supposed to help me up or something. I love how
awkward he is with her here, and what's coming up is kind of one of my favorite little moments. Okay. And that was one of the, like, she is the only girl in all the auditions who, like, got that line really the way. Okay, that's, this is, by the way, Mickey Raphael, the, like, world's best harmonica player.
Oh, don't tell him that. You've just ruined the illusion. They don't need to know that.
I thought that was DVD commentary stuff.
Yes. No, that's Sophie.
Okay.
Well, we gave
She's
her credit.
That good.
Well, she did learn to play Django Reinhardt left-handed, really.
Okay, so. This is the part where I can't look because I always laugh hysterically. I think it's so sweet. Trying to impress her. Oh, God.
You play on the upraising like me. You have very long fingers. The people tell you.
I remember somewhere in the process you telling me, you know, you need to, if you're going to keep this line in, you need to make sure those actors have long fingers.
Unusually long fingers.
What was that again?
Unusually long fingers.
Yeah.
I'm not in yet. Still have a final audition.
Well, do you need anything special?
This one was a really hard day because also Sophie's a minor, so you can't really shoot long hours with them, and we were down to the wire.
This is like a 6 or 7 page scene.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and we had to get it, and also it was supposed to start raining right after, so it was a lot of pressure on them, but I think they really pulled it off.
Oh, yeah, I love the scene.
No, thanks.
Okay. You know, I've been thinking. Aren't you a little young to be in New York City all by yourself?
You don't get a say.
Why don't I get a say?
Because it's none of your business.
Yeah. Oh, see the flag in the background was a big. I wanted to keep the flag.
Yeah, well,
So there, things have begin to disappear from his house, as you can see.
Yes,
getting more and more empty, and you can hear it as well. It's sounding a little more hollow.
Mm-hmm. And here, when you go into the bathroom, we're actually cheating this, and it was at a different location, but we it matches well. We were happy about that.
I kind of like the fact that, you know, after all of May's caterwauling, or it's, you know, living from hand to mouth for her whole life, it doesn't take her too long to start loving the good life. She's reading books and bubble baths, smoking away, not a care in the world.
May would always be reading in the bath. It's just that this is a nicer bath.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's just, you know, she's taken to it. She's taken to the good life, yes. Like without any pain. No doubt she's filled that tub up about like 3 times during this bath stay alone.
Yes.
Oh, well, this was, I felt bad for her. She was like sitting in a lukewarm bath and we kept having to be like, oh, put more bubbles over her boobs. We're catching boob.
She was a very good sport about this scene.
I love
nice
the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was, John really knocked this one out of the park too.
Here.
That was actually a really hard shot to get because the bathroom was so small, and I think we had the boom
big
and probably
boom
like 9 out of the 10 takes or whatever. It was. And it was actually near kind of a busy street, too, so there was a lot of traffic to contend with.
I love this scene. I think there's tender, nice stuff going on here.
And you guys did a really good job in the editing of just deciding when to have the May character soften up.
Mm-hmm.
That became an issue in longer cuts of the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And you guys eventually found just the right right balance mm-hmm. of her being hard and soft.
And when she starts to soften up, yeah.
This is actually this French band that's not French. They're faux French. Listen, I'm probably going to butcher it. Listen, Culotte. But we tried so many different types of music there. We had some really cool Wu-Tang there for a little while.
Johnny Cigarette.
And Todd King. That's our line producer that we made him go on the poster.
That's supposed to be Heath Ledger, right?
Yeah, initially it was Heath Ledger, but then we couldn't get the rights, and she says something disparaging about him. So, but this is one thing we had
to
sacrifice.
Which, by the way, you can actually do. You guys didn't have to look that up because he's a public figure.
Talk to your attorney.
That wasn't why we were told we had to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing is this is
Only
one
me.
Sacrifice.
I didn't want to do that.
One sacrifice we had to make here because we were right on the brink of getting PG-13. Was there was a line here when she said soft cock, and apparently the MPAA hates the word cock. You could have people dying in movies and blood everywhere, but if you say the word cock, you're definitely an R. And so we had to use another word.
Tough thing for me to swallow.
Yeah.
I thought this should be an R.
So it wasn't the heat.
No, it was a PG-13 versus R. And
I have to say I don't think this should be an R. This is a movie for young girls.
Well, that's what we had to cut. You know, it was very painful because we had three cocks.
By the way, they're all
we had three cocks we had to cut.
Yeah.
But it was worth it at the end of the day because it is a movie. People like Sophie, she's not, we mm-hmm. need her to be able to come to the movie.
No, mm-hmm. I agree. Now, look, by the way, cut to when it comes out on DVD and video and cable, everyone's going to see it no matter what the rating is,
Yes.
Yeah.
Hence, little kids coming up to me telling me how great Kill Bill is.
Mm-hmm.
And their parents. Like, oh, it's Billy's favorite movie.
That's excellent.
I agree. But no. It's like, this is a perfect movie for a young girl.
Yeah.
I'm too skinny and I've got no ass and boys.
One of the things that I responded to in reading the script was the dialogue. Your dialogue is very well written, has a really good Southern vernacular, and its use of the use of the vernacular and the adjectives and stuff and that rhythm. But the thing that really impressed me with the short film that you wrote, that was the first thing we worked on. First thing we worked on again, was how well you wrote guys. Really good dialogue, really good guy dialogue for a gal.
Thank you. I think you write excellent female dialogue.
Thank you very much. Danielle, what attracted you to the script when you read it?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, first of all, you gave me the script, so the fact of working with you, I was really intrigued by and thought could be very interesting. But lo and behold, I had known Katrina, and you didn't know that, I think. You were... Mm-hmm. Quentin did a little setup with us, thinking I would be a good match of a producer for her. Lo and behold, I've known Katrina for a long time. And I'd been hearing about the script. That was what was driving me crazy, because I had never read it, and we have the same lawyer or different people in our lives that are the same. And I've always been hearing about Katrina wrote this amazing script, and she there's all this heat on it and all, ups and downs. And so when I read the script, I was in prep on another movie, so I was super stressed out and I could not put it down. And I always joke with Katrina because I feel like we're both, mid-30 women stuck in, the brains of 14-year-old girls or something. I'm not quite saying that right. But June is... I felt so connected to her story and her being a 14-year-old girl and the goofiness and trying to figure out, grapple with who you are and where you fit in and how do you make a family, and I connected to it maybe because I also come from kind of a makeshift family, and I felt like there was a real sweetness to it there of how June kind of navigated this world and brought all these people into her life. But I also loved the humor of the script, too, because it had a real heart, but it was also really funny. So, I mean, I have to say I felt like I hit the jackpot.
Herself nothing while denying us most everything.
Here we are back to Beth Grant, one of my favorite actresses ever, and this we're back with our Bleach bypass flashback.
You might remember Beth Grant in as the nervous woman who gets blown up in Speed.
Yeah.
She's the nervous old lady who's actually the only person to die in Speed.
Wow.
I mean, and on the bus.
She was also, I saw her recently, I rented Donnie Darko. She was in that. She's been in everything.
So these, you really can read the titles of the books, which makes me very happy. It's Phantom Tollbooth.
So. Now, is this pretty much a good collection of the films, the books that the young Katrina read?
Absolutely. Especially the last one.
There's To Kill a Mockingbird, which actually played a big part in Katrina's
development.
Coming of age.
Is there any book she reads that you haven't read that was just put in there?
No, this is G.H. Lawrence. Absolutely not. Every single book in here I've read.
Seminal book for you?
Yeah, because these are all, I mean, she's very curious about her sexuality. Yeah, you hear, ooh, topic of it. What to me people haven't commented on that cracks me up is the fact that her mom allows her to read these books, which I think is really cool, you know.
Yeah, like the illustrated Kama Sutra.
Yeah.
And I kind of actually like the idea of the Sophie eating buttered bread while she's looking at a 69.
This is a movie for young girls. We're talking PG-13, remember.
I have to love the cheesy, awful, Bad News Bears poster.
Interesting.
No one will ever know that's a Bad News Bears poster unless I say it.
I agree.
But again, like, we were up against Paramount was all over our ass because they were going to put out the remake that we could not get rights to anything, and they knew about it because we had to clear, or it's my job with, and it sounds like you don't agree, but like to make sure that everything's cleared, all the images and all the books, and actually the Giving Tree was one book. Wasn't that the book that they wouldn't let us use, Katrina? Which was so surprising.
Well, actually, it would make sense that they wouldn't let you use the Bad News Bears poster because actually it's a very famous drawing. Mm-hmm. Jack Davis is a really famous illustrator.
At one point, we did want to try to find Richard Linklater and beg or someone.
I thought
it
would have been good publicity for their upcoming movie.
Actually,
what might have been
the case is the fact that maybe Paramount didn't even own Jack Davis's artwork. All right, and so they just gave you a no because
they couldn't say yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Again, which is part of the thing. Sometimes, you know, companies don't have the rights, and very rarely do they say, oh, by the way, we don't have it. They just say no.
Yeah. Well, that one we pushed hard on because it was something that was like of sentimental value to Katrina and I knew to you too, but they were hardcore on that one.
No, I'm not getting in your case for not having the real poster there, but
we had to have something, even if it's just the three of us in this room know what it is.
The cheesy one with the vaguely Walter Matthau guy in there. Doyle's art project from when the movie came out.
This is one of my favorite scenes too. Katrina, do you want to talk a little bit about this one?
This was a very specific, I mean, we shortlisted this, Matt Irving. This was going back to, like, being on the lot, and every time we got pushed a little bit due to Kill Bill, thank God we kept getting pushed because we had more and more time to shortlist. So we did, this actually was one of the things that really didn't change very much on the day. It was pretty specific and kind of complicated, and I love it because I feel like there's this mysterious, subtle thing going back and forth between the two women, and we get it.
I love that. I actually love this shot.
Yeah.
What's the name?
That is a jackalope.
Okay.
That's a jackalope. What the jackalope will be featured again?
You had told me what it was, and even now I was like forgot about it. I go, is that a rodent with deer horns?
And this was an awesome find. The store was pretty dressed. It was pretty as is.
My husband, he had the same cheeks and the dark circles.
Matt Irving, my DP, would come to the lot, the old Warner Hollywood lot. I think like up to 3 months ahead. We kept getting pushed. And so that gave us the opportunity to do this shot list, which I consider, I mean, I think what we started out with, this movie, it just, it looks so much more than the money that we have. You know, it's just beautiful. And we campaigned for this anamorphic lens. And he sort of, Matt had never shot anamorphic before. And when I met him, I said, look, this is really what I want to do. And I'm being told, no, you know, first time filmmaker, stay away from it. But here's why. And he got it. And we just, you know, basically bugged the crap out of Danielle, who in turn bugged the crap out of you. And I think have this beautiful looking movie that looks like a fable. And I love Matt Irving. There you go. And he also let me, I mean, I was smack up next to him the whole time. And Liz, our focus puller, I'm not a fan of Video Village. And I was like, hey, guys, dolly riding me next to the camera, all that. And, you know, that was, it's very close proximity. And to have that kind of relationship was really, really good. This is the scene where, like, old men have come up and then you really got me in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this is just,
which is nice.
And they match up as a mother and daughter here in this scene very good.
Don't stop playing, baby. I love your playing.
And initially, I mean, this scene was much longer and they talked a lot more, but we found they gave such strong performances, you didn't need it, you know? You just wanted to, like, spend time with them, but they didn't have to talk.
Saying goodbye to someone you love is impossible. It's much easier to say, see you later, maybe in heaven.
It was really funny that, you know, the first night that Sophie had flown into Tennessee, probably the day before that Elizabeth Banks got there, and she showed up, Elizabeth showed up at the hotel, and we introduced her to Sophie, and it didn't register at first that this was Sophie who was going to play June in the movie. And when we told Elizabeth that, her jaw dropped because Sophie was about 2 feet taller than her, and it took Elizabeth a little while to come to terms with this is the girl that was going to play her daughter.
Are you real sad?
Get out.
I love this scene because this is such a kid, you know, it's a sad, sentimental thing, but she just tells it like it is. She's like, you suck, you sound like shit.
Yeah, right.
And I love that because she's mourning, but it's the truth, you know?
And actually, it was first of all, this room was about 90 degrees, so they were both dripping with sweat, but I was sitting in the hallway with Sophie's mother watching this on the monitor, and it was so painful for her because she's watching her daughter do this, and Sophie was really bawling at certain points, and her mom just so wanted to run in there and, like, comfort her, but she's like, but it's a movie, but it's not real, but she's so sad. It was really, really hard for her.
Out in the room.
I listened to the tapes, and I do my phonics. Listen. Char. Charlie.
You suck. You sound like shit.
I love that she takes to her bed and she still has her glasses.
And if you saw Katrina right now, you would see her glasses. Which she never takes off.
Yeah, and I like the fact that she says, you suck, you sound like shit.
Mm-hmm. It's like, again, cracks people up.
Yeah.
David Koechner made me cry in the audition. He, I believe, came up through Second City, started as a comedian, and did a stint on Saturday Night Live. And
Saturday Night Live, I was the host of. He was a member of the cast at that time.
Right. And he just, you know, came in and kind of blew us all away.
Now he's in every other comedy movie
release. This was in one of David Koechner's audition scenes. And when he left, I was just like,
wah. Now, let me ask y'all a question, because you decided on David Koechner, and he's terrific in the film. Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, I remember correctly,
you don't have to mention his name, but there was another actor, and mm-hmm. you guys were looking at two actors in particular, David and another guy, and they both went kind of really different ways mm-hmm. with the character. What made you all decide to go with David?
I thought that David's vulnerability was just he made it real, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to it's a tight rope, the part of Doyle. And
but I felt like David's take on it was much sweeter, and that's for some reason Katrina wanted to go sweeter. This other guy was mm-hmm. a bit more edgy, who's mm-hmm. a fabulous actor, and I've mm-hmm. actually done two movies with him and really love him, but David brought a certain sweetness, and he also has kids, and somehow that might have affected his performance. Or I mean, he got Katrina bawling. He got Katrina bawling in the audition,
basically. But the physicality of both of the actors and the part, who's supposed to be a really big guy, mm-hmm. and that can be scary and mm-hmm. intimidating. It could slightly go the wrong way mm-hmm. with a little girl and a big mm-hmm. guy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that David, there was a sweetness.
Right. So.
And this is actually this performance by Johnny Knoxville, I think, is one of his most subtle and really moving and honest.
This was Juliet's last day. She wrapped out this day, too.
Well, do you talk to anyone about this?
Yeah.
The scene turns more comedic, but I think for him, he was really nervous about this day, I felt mm-hmm. like. I mean, because he had the, you know, all the kind of sex stuff, but also it was really, he had to be real vulnerable.
Yeah, and well, it's only now that the audience realizes that people don't know that Daltrey that Daltrey has actually been pulling off his ruse. Mm-hmm, that the mm-hmm. town knows that the place is in trouble, but doesn't know that he's like
the extent of it.
Yeah, that he's like
the house could go.
Yeah, in a second.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually one of my favorite lines. I don't know how much. One of my favorite lines is in this scene. I don't know how much an audience gets it because I don't know if they really know who Arlo and Eugene is by name, even though they introduce themselves in the movie. It's one of those things that mm-hmm. doesn't stay. But I actually think one of the best lines in the movie is me and Arlo and Eugene we're trying to keep it together, and then she goes, "Well, do you talk to anybody about this?" "Yeah, I talk to Arlo and Eugene."
Yes.
I talked to the guys who were overseeing the bankruptcy about my bankruptcy.
It's just setting her straight.
So this scene initially in editing had kind of a different button on the ending. It was more comedic. It was more like there was a joke about Daltrey being a premature ejaculator, but then we found like it didn't quite, we wanted to go back to the more emotional beat with June. But I mean, that's one thing I love about Katrina's writing. Like in the same scene, you can have something so moving and someone so vulnerable, and then it can be hilarious.
You know, kudos to the costume designer
Minka on, Draper.
All of Juliet's outfits from here on in.
Absolutely. Yeah.
These little Argyle sweaters are so cool on her, and she wears them so good. And
that's called good sweater meat.
Yeah, there's a green one coming up that in particular for
her. Minka Draper, which I think is a wonderful name for a costume designer.
I would agree.
Mm-hmm. But watch what Johnny does with his hand in his face in a minute after Sophie comes mm-hmm. in, and he doesn't know if he's been caught or not.
Yeah, I love Sophie's, you know, sleepwalking zombie comes
but
down to get.
That's what, you know.
No, I know, but I love the, you know, just comes, you know, leaves her room long enough to grab a soda and a bite, go back upstairs.
Yeah. Well, she's not going upstairs.
Yeah, she's going outside.
Now, this was an interesting night. Do you remember shooting this?
This was actually the last night. This was. Sophie turned 15 on this night. I think the Red Sox won the World Series. Like everyone was listening
was
to the World Series
total
game.
Total lunar eclipse. Yeah.
And Griffin Electric was chanting MOS, MOS, because we.
Yeah, there was a lot of tension on the set between the sound department and the other departments, but. We always knew this would. I mean, we wanted production sound, obviously, but
if I'm not mistaken, I think this might be the only car mount scene in the whole movie.
It was, mm-hmm. I think you're right. For
if
the scene we cut the accident.
What we cut. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Doesn't count.
Yeah.
But lighting that house was actually quite a feat. And there was so much fog that night.
So that looks great.
In England.
Yeah.
Do you find the people pretty nice here? People are wonderful and they're from all over.
I always thought a still from here would have been a really good poster.
You know, one of the things that's really great about Johnny in this film is the fact that he is a really good comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing is, he's just always, not in a reflex thing, but just, he's, you know, if ever there's a funny bit of business,
yeah,
he can put into a scene, you know, he'll try.
So you're going to call social services on me or what?
What?
And Johnny did such a good job with this. And we got, like, pretty friendly. You know, during the making of it, the parting and the celebrating of it.
The celebrating of it.
The celebrating of it.
The moonshine of
it. Yeah, my Bermuda Triangle Tennessee visit when I just went missing for two days.
Went MIA for 48 hours with his moonshine at the Jameson, and are we allowed to talk about that?
Oh, we can talk about that. I think you just did.
It's a mystical experience.
I had a very mystical experience. It was very Carlos Castaneda.
Yeah.
in the Columbia.
The
Jameson Inn in Columbia, Tennessee.
And you didn't even have Applebee's delivered. You were so MIA.
Yes, I was. Yeah. Just people were knocking on the door, and I'm all good, guys. See you later. I actually remember coming on the set the day I'm going to leave. And you're like, Quentin, are you okay? And I go, I actually had one of the most mind-bending experiences of my life. You're too busy right now, but when the film's over, I'll tell you about it someday.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
So weren't you supposed to be talking about Johnny Knoxville?
Yes. actually, I was.
Were you locked in the room with Johnny?
Yeah. He's in a part in a film that I'm executive producing right now called Killshot, based on an Elmer Leonard novel, and he's got a role in that one as well. And he's going to do a fantastic job.
This is Skeeter Davis, and she, I think she died our first day of filming.
So oh, yeah. That actually,
Tennessee.
That makes sense, yeah.
Go on singing.
Why
do the stars glow?
I remember the first time I heard the song, and then I go, hey, didn't she just die this year? And you were like,
yeah, as a matter of fact.
our editor actually had really good musical taste, and he was there for that day, and was kind of inspired by that and brought in some of our music. That's one thing, too, I love so much about the movie is the eclectic soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. No, the soundtrack's terrific.
Yeah. I love that. Yes.
This is lonely June, looking at all. Yeah. Everybody else has somebody.
Yeah.
Those were these cute little skateboarder guys who, like, kept coming up to Johnny trying to get his autograph. And then one day I said, hey, do you guys want to actually be in the movie? And they were really excited about it.
And this couple right here, they were very excited. They were not a couple in real life. So this guy was very happy.
Yeah, so he's just totally pimping it.
Yeah. I love this so much. I know something's about to come up where you want her to get run over.
But oh, yeah. But I just,
and one of my most emotional.
I know. Just every time I've seen the film, I just, like, you know, put my own, like, transfer trailer truck that just drives by and plows her over. Going
great.
From right to left. Yeah. Wah, wah, the end.
That would be a short.
And then tragedy struck.
I think this is coming up is I don't even think I can talk during this scene because I think this is my favorite scene in the whole movie.
You know, Sophie had never been drunk before. So for her to act drunk, she was really nervous about it. And she talked to Juliet for a long time beforehand who gave her all these pointers.
Yeah, there
pointers.
You go. That's, with the expert.
No. I made it sound worse. But I think she did a great job.
She was very nervous about the scene.
Yeah, and this was another
and
night.
And Katrina started feeding her Jägermeister in between shots, and then bam.
I think you Go wanted figure. To, and I put the kibosh on it.
Here's a little moment that we added in post that I love, where because she's a little buzzed, she accidentally turns it down.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, actually, and then like, oops, and turn.
Well, her playing just a nanosecond of on the harmonica is my favorite. Is yes. my favorite part.
Yeah. I wish we did it more.
And me too. it's like she would have like my top five favorite moments of the entire movie is that little thing.
And I love his dancing. I remember that night, Kit came up to you, Katrina, and was like, "I have an idea. What if I started dancing?" And
oh, I remember
and
you're them like, dancing yeah. together at Hux. Talking about this scene.
Yeah. Oh God. And this was one of those nights that went. We were
Hux
going
was a,
so late.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hux is this really cool divey bar that's in the city of Tennessee.
But if they Columbia. Like you in Columbia, if they like Columbia. You, they'll invite you for some moonshine. But otherwise, it's just beer.
Yeah, exactly.
And they like Quentin.
Yes, they like me. I still have my keychain. I would carry around proudly. But the thing about her playing those just that one little two little notes. From this song is one of those cool things that I wish we had realized how cool that was a character trait. Not even just on the, I mean, she could have done it through different parts of the movie. Just picked up the, just picked up the thing and just played whatever song, you know, played it with every song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a cool little character trait. And there's also something kind of wonderful about the fact that.
Oh no. I know where you're going with
Where are you going?
Yes,
where are you going?
Can I go there?
And by the way, you can because when I say, I mean, I put that in your, that's your.
Okay. So what I'm referring to is the fact that.
The character harmonica.
Yes. Is she plays harmonica in the, and there's a very famous character in Western film who's known as Harmonica, played by Charles Bronson in the Sergio Leone masterpiece Once Upon a Time in the West. And that actor, Charles Bronson, just happens to be Katrina's pop.
And that was one of the inspirations for June playing harmonica.
Yes. And of all, and I think Rider in the Rain aside, that's your favorite performance by, and your favorite character by your father.
Yes. Although there's something about hearing him say, all right, love, love.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly.
And Katrina has a dog named Love, Love, right, who is thanked in the credits.
Yes.
We weren't supposed to give that away because people think Love, Love is like a really cool rapper.
Yeah. So thanks, Love, Love.
Yeah. Now Love, Love's on the DVD.
L-U-V,
great.
L-U-V.
Yeah. Yeah. L-U-V-L-U-V, a.k.a. L-squared.
Yeah.
Tongues, I mean, I'd never even pecked... a boy.
Well, that's all very exciting in your future, June.
Frankie, will you teach
And this
me?
Was a real hard one for them because we weren't getting coverage on this. You know, this was all one take. And, you
As
know...
As it should have been, though. I mean, I...
Well,
I
don't, no, I agree, but I'm just saying, you know, also, we're a real low-budget movie. We shot 27 days, and, you know, we can't just... keep doing take after take, so there's always that pressure of like, you know, we only have so much film allotted for today, you guys better get it.
But
I think they really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, and I think that particular the moment of them on the stairs needed to stand.
Dumbass, how could I ever think that you don't want to kiss me or take my virginity?
June, there was no mention of virginity. You said kiss. I said I didn't even want to do that.
I'm still losing.
And this was really Sophie's first movie. I mean, she shot for half a day where she didn't have any words.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even think it was used in the interpreter. But, I mean, she, you know, for her first movie to, you know, be the main character is pretty hardcore. She really stepped up to the plate and...
And she does a great job, you know, being the lead of the picture.
Yeah.
And
with
as
Johnny.
And as we were all hanging out, going to Hux afterwards, she had to do homework. I mean, because she's only 14, so she had a set teacher. And so
she had a couple good nights at Hux.
Well, I'm saying she did. She didn't, you know, nothing illegal. But you know, she was working her butt off.
Yeah, well,
you
know? I was thinking, wait a minute, she was at the bar too, wasn't
just
she?
Just that night when you came into town, but she wasn't a local there. Oh, they're going to shut it down now, you guys. They're going to shut it down.
I seem to remember her dancing to the jukebox in the bar, but maybe that was just me.
That was one night.
I think you're probably right.
In the rain and the snow, when there's nowhere to go.
I don't know why. I mean, this is like my favorite shot in the whole movie. I've never been so happy to see someone puke.
This is actually probably my favorite shot in the whole movie, too.
This is interesting because this is one of the songs from the original Dog Year, like, wall writing list of wish lists.
And I just think he's so tender here. There's something so sweet about it. It just gets me every time. And this was one of those songs, too, where we had it, and it was our temp, and I was like, we are going to get this come hell or high water.
Hey, you know, a boyfriend who holds your hair as you puke, that's a find, all right? When your dad holds your hair as you puke, that's like, wow, I won the dad lottery.
I love the same temp. Ah,
there's the green sweater I like so much.
Yeah.
Green Argyle. Again, another one of the big laughs.
Yeah.
We get like full on Juliet flirty body language.
Mm-hmm.
Her girly body language is half her character.
Yeah. She has these, I call them her Flora flourishes.
Yeah.
Like she does her little shoulder lift or her little look over her.
And when I was saying before, it wasn't that I didn't care for the character Flora in the script. It's just in the script, she didn't dominate the second half of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
She was what she was. And then with Juliet's interpretation of it and her playing it, it's like she's one of the stars in the movie. And she dominates the second half of it in a great way.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah, it's the Flora flourish.
Well, I remember the first night that she got to Tennessee and we did a table read. Mm-hmm. And she had actually been working out right before. Her hair was wet. She was wearing sweatpants and a T-shirt. And she went right into Flora. It was like, it was unbelievable. Everybody couldn't take their eyes off of her. And you know, she just became that, you know, even in her sweatpants, she was Flora Flick, you know?
You know, I actually think one of the things is, I think in the script I always read Flora as being older. Now, I don't think that's what you intended, because I would bring up actresses and you go, oh, I think they might be a little too old.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think we ever even verbalized it, but I think that actually that was one of the things. I think I always just saw her as just a little older.
You know, that's interesting. You're right. Because we didn't ever say that that's what it was, but you would say, you're like, this persistent. I was like, I wasn't thinking that, but I never said,
I hadn't even put it together until just now that we were on different pages as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now he's going to use a little... I Ebonics here.
You
that,
should talk about that.
Yeah, well.
You walk out! That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. I have a friend who's also a friend of Danielle's, all right? Danielle produced a film called Double Dare, and starring the New Zealand stunt lady, Zoe Bell. And I worked with Zoe Bell in Kill Bill, and from time to time she would use Ebonics, Kiwi accent, and it was very, very funny. And I started doing it. And
can you do it right now?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And
you should have done an accent for this entire commentary. You have a flawless accent.
And so the thing is, it's like some of those things, like that's what I'm talking about. I can't even say it without saying it in an Australian accent now. And when I was visiting the set and we were all drinking at Huck's, with Sophie, drinking moonshine with the 14-year-old at Huck's.
Not true.
After an 18-hour day.
Yeah, after an 18-hour day. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, to Carolee Larson,
no
her mother, right now, just so you know.
And it was a strip club, no less. So, I was like, Sophie's got some work ethic, man.
I know.
After 18 hours of entertaining the customers, I couldn't have done it.
Stop. I'm hurting.
I asked Danielle, I was like, is this okay? And I was like, don't worry about it.
What happens in Tennessee
stays
in Tennessee.
Her 21-year-old boyfriend came to visit.
No. Totally untrue.
Hey, there's the Edgar Poncho Pool.
Yes. No.
That's not Edgar Poncho Pool.
No.
Who is that?
No. That's actually Harold, who was one of our Teamsters.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is like a random assignment.
I wish I hadn't said something. I thought it was Edgar Poncho Pool.
Well,
he's a character.
He looks very close to he looks like Edgar Poncho Pool.
Yeah.
He does.
This actually we shot in two different days. The two shot of them, and then the singles we shot on a different day because we were so under the gun and we couldn't get the singles, and we just thought we could cut without it. And luckily we were able to go back and get the singles, because I think it would have been really sad to do it all in a two shot. And it was raining on this day, so we had tents over them, but I think we were able to color time it so it matched pretty well. So.
Alligator shirt. Yeah. Do they still make those?
Yes. Yes. They're
I own one in every color.
Style.
Yes. I wanted her to have that kind of a thing. It's her uniform. Flora has uniforms.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, she has her more feminine uniforms, but that's her.
No, that's a perfect perfect working behind a counter uniform shirt that's not a uniform.
Yeah.
And the C. Eileen would go to Warco Bank, which Eugene's been.
It's almost fixed.
Eugene's been.
My negotiation.
We knocked
These guys just make me smile every time Matthew and James come on.
We knocked on neighbors' doors because we realized we wanted to give them something to do, and we wanted a flask. Mm-hmm. So we just got one from the neighbor right before we started shooting.
My proposal that will be accepted on the precedent that CI was tremendously profitable at one point. A cash cow. It simply needs to be under better management.
Love Should I break house. The illusion?
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, well, that you can. Okay. That was Sophie Standen, because it was too late at night. The cute girl who walks away that Kate Curry notices.
This is Johnny and supposed to be Daltrey. Mm-hmm. Better times. Yeah. When he first got his house.
Who's Adam Kramer?
He was a realtor in Columbia. They had a sign graveyard where they had all these. Well, you didn't get a sign from the graveyard.
Yeah, but yeah.
Again, this is like how nice and welcoming the people in this town were. We drove by this house and it was so picture perfect, and we knew that Flora would live in a house that was just done to the nines, you know? And of course our locations woman knew everybody in town, and she introduced us to this woman. We nicknamed her Flora Kate. Now I don't even know what her real name is, but this was all of her stuff. This is what her house looked like. We didn't have to do anything to it, basically. And I mean, if we were to build this, or you know, to dress something like this, it would have cost tens of thousands of dollars. And she just invited us into her home, and you know, and she didn't even hate us afterwards. I was sure that, you know, we were taking over because she was a little naive and didn't realize. But she was a really... Well, her husband was really cool and was actually a golf pro and was the one who taught Johnny how to play golf.
Oh, really?
So, was he not? No, he was. Katrina's telling me I got it wrong. Yes.
Not Flora Kate's husband.
Yeah.
Not Flora Kate's husband. It was the guy who owned the... I'll show you when we get to
it. Well, now I'm going to start gossip in Columbia, because I saw them hanging out. I don't know. Those aren't really Sophie's feet.
The Converse are very, very important to me, too. She has her one pair of Converse to the whole.
But this was a stressful night because we were down for so long because of the generator. And Sophie's dad, her mom came with her to set, but her dad was still up in Toronto. And he came down for maybe 2 days to hang out and see what it was like. And it was this night, and we were running so late, and I was so worried he was going to have a hard time with it. But her parents were so cool and so supportive of us and the movie. And they kind of, you know, took Katrina and I under their wing a little bit. But... it was interesting. Her dad is a sound recordist, so he didn't even want to look at the monitor or anything. He just wanted headphones.
That's cool.
I know. He. That's how he enjoyed it.
I like how Flora just accepts the
I know.
The saliva with the
I've always liked that, too. Yeah, I always thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And I like the way I like the way, and I like the way Sophie looks in this.
Yeah.
I like everything about this scene.
She's so tall. There, I feel like we have Juliet up on an Apple box, actually.
I watch when she goes over and she can't see herself. Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah.
That's very Katrina.
If you look really closely, well, oh
well. Well, we can see you watching the
scene. No. I just love in the mirror in the back you see Juliet. I don't know. I love that Flora watching her in that. Gosh, if you could see me in the background, that would not be a good thing. I wouldn't be pointing that out.
Yes. Look really closely in the mirror. You can see a fat grip holding a flag. See, there's a crack of his ass. You can barely make it out. He's sticking it out of his back of his pants.
I don't know if people can see in the DVD, but the necklace that June wears out is was her mother's necklace. So she, after the mom dies, she wears that for the rest of the movie.
Well, it's funny because it's also kind of weird. Actually, Uma said she had the same problem with the Kill Bill. Was I remember the script so well that from time to time I'll forget that this line is not in the movie, or this you know what I mean? You just remember things. And sometimes they, you know, either didn't make it the cut or you never shot it in the first place. But I have memories of it. One of the memories I have is in May's scene when she gets the necklace. She goes, "What are you wasting your money on?"
Yeah,
why are you wasting your money on this? June better get this when I die.
Yes. Yeah.
Not give it to some floozy.
Shouldn't go to this floozy. Make sure it doesn't go to a floozy. It's some floozy.
Yeah, I love that line.
And while all of us were regathering our strength and redoubling our efforts, Daltrey had all but given up.
So there's that dog.
That's your dog portrait.
That's one of my favorite things. And one of her great lines is coming out. And what about you getting your life back together? Was that crap too?
And one of the things that was really hard, I think, for the actors on this, I mean, for the crew too, but because the weather was so crazy and unpredictable, they had to basically be prepared for an exterior scene and an interior scene. So there was no, like, emotional continuity. Yeah. So they were ready to, like, do golfy golf stuff or do this emotional scene, you know. And this was a very last-minute change, I remember, because we were supposed to be shooting outside that day. But I think they both did a really good job.
Well, that was one of the kind of things, is making sure that they knew where they were coming from in the narrative order. Mm-hmm. Because of having to shoot out of context, like, okay, emotionally, remember what just happened here.
Yeah, but that's an important thing for all directors to remember. Yeah, all right, you know, either if you've never done it before or if you've done it 20 times, because it's easy to
where are they in the emotional?
It's part of your job, actually, is to always keep the actors grounded in the drama of the situation, and you know. What happened previously, just previous to this, emotionally keeping them on base of where they're at in the story.
And
they don't have time to think about that all the time.
Yeah, and we started this whole project being everybody knew, all right, this is our shoot. Because of this, we will be shooting out of context. So everybody came on board kind of knowing, you know, that we would, I would reassure Johnny, okay, well, we're going to take time and go back and see, okay, where were we here and this, that. Yeah. And that was, you know, we all knew.
But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like this was a 27-day shoot, and we really had to let the locations dictate the schedule for the most part. But, you know, all these guys were total team players, and no one really complained about it. But, you know, maybe one day I'll make a movie where you shoot it in order, but I doubt it.
Or at least emotional continuity.
Exactly. This song was such a great last minute find too. This is Ed Harcourt,
and last minute.
I really loved it.
You fixed it. I sit and persevere. You fixed it.
So, and actually here, this was right near the house that we shot this, and then we go, you know, to this next shot that was on an entirely different location.
And if you stay till the very, very, very end of the DVD, after the copyright stuff, you'll see some outtakes from this area that are kind of crazy. They said it wouldn't last.
You proved. I had a little breakdown that day about the sign. Because yeah. They painted it right before we started shooting, which I was totally pissed about. And then they wrote Duckland Highlandville instead of Ducktown, because we're supposed to be in Ducktown, so we had to do like last minute, but the paint was still totally wet, so we didn't have any doubles of Juliet's clothes and stuff, so we're just like, please don't get the paint on your clothes. But I mean, that's what happens, low budge, but it worked out.
No, the people doing stuff last minute happens big budge too, all right? It's what's so frustrating about
it. I have a fantasy that it doesn't happen like that.
No, it's what's frustrating about it. Like, you decided to do that now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll remember how it was.
They said it would. This is our getting into our magical realism stuff.
Oh, and Look Effects, who did our golf balls. We had such a good experience with them. If you're looking for golf balls or any other visual effects, keep time with bad thoughts too high. Or
James Parks has actually played a recurring character in my movie universe. All right, he's
that's Ron
Edgar.
Sorry, who owns the house? That's the guy.
He's Edgar McGraw in Dusk Till Dawn 2, directed by Scott Spiegel, and he recreates the character Edgar in Kill Bill Volume 1. And his father played the character Earl McGraw, his father, Texas Ranger Earl McGraw, in Dusk Till Dawn Volume, the first Dusk Till Dawn, not Volume Anything, just Dusk Till Dawn, and Kill Bill Volume 1.
Our sepia outtone. So this is the epilogue. Notice the about. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the beginning. I like to keep the time ambiguous.
The guy on the left, we told the casting director we want someone who looks like Freud. He was so cute. I wish you could see him more. But, I mean, Sophie's really playing, and she's really playing left-handed. Which is, I mean, pretty impressive. And what, we got her 5 guitar lessons or something like that?
Yeah, no, she's pretty impressive in that.
And these were real musician students that Anastasia Brown, our music supervisor, found, who came in and, you know.
And I like how, just Sophie's, like, just vaguely sexier, vaguely more cosmopolitan, vaguely more grown up.
And she has her Martin D45 with Avalone Inlet.
Yes.
Which is what she wanted from the very beginning.
And she's obviously like flirting with guys and, you know, living the college life, even though it was only high school.
But it was that was such a coup. And I don't think Katrina and I really realized how nervous she was that she was going to be able to pull it off. Mm-hmm. And she had been, we got her some lessons, but then she would practice every night with her mom too. And so when she pulled it off, it was so emotional and her mom was crying and we all started, and it was such a sweet moment, you know, and she worked so hard. Ducktown Highlandville.
Daltrey and Flora really did fall in love. They got married and had my sister.
Now this baby behaved perfectly compared to the toddler in the prologue.
And just so you know, it's a real baby because we did at some point show this film to other filmmakers to get some feedback, and Katrina showed it to Chris Weitz, who thought it was a fake baby.
You can't trick me with the rubber baby.
We were like, that is not a rubber baby.
And this band is actually a local Tennessee band, Blue Mother Tupelo. Nashville band doing a cover version of Paul Anka's Put Your Head on My Shoulder with a dobro and slide guitar, which I just love. And then we will gradually go into one of my favorite pieces of music in the whole thing. We we supposed to comment on the people in the
car? You can say, yes.
Well, Armanda, our camera operator, we just finished the end credit music video with her. She shot that. She shot that on Super 16.
And if there's anybody you don't like, too, and the name comes up, feel free to, you know, torpedo.
Just a kiss goodnight, maybe. You and I will fall in love. People say that love's a game. And our transpo department rocked. The Teamsters were really... they all went to Juliet's show when she played in Nashville. Mm-hmm. The next day, everybody on the crew was wearing... Juliet and the Licks t-shirts. Uh-huh. You know, it was very interesting.
Look at our kick-ass soundtrack credits. I'm proud of that.
I'm watching and looking.
Yeah, Holly Williams is a granddaughter of Hank Williams, who has a song in Flora's Store. So this mashup, Wu-Tang and Marty Robbins.
Thank you to RZA for letting us do it.
And for smiling when he heard it.
at the premiere.
Yeah, that was a moment for me. Yeah. Sitting behind them, like, that was scary, you know? Yeah. I was just going to pass the muster.
Katrina was sitting directly behind RZA, right, and, you know.
He looked
watching
happy.
Watching him.
Well, I wasn't watching the movie. I'm watching them watch the
movie. Yeah, you were actually watching him and his sisters, all right, you know, watch the movie.
Tomcat's Catering rocks.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
It's making me hungry right now just thinking about it. That was the one thing. On low-budget movies, no matter how low-budget they are, you have to have good food. It's the only thing that keeps people in a good mood.
Our special
thanks.
We
were so lucky.
Yeah. Our special thanks list is probably longer than our credits. That's been, rightly
don't
so.
Don't they say it's always inversely proportionate to the budget?
Yeah, no, I just got back from a...
Yeah, I know what you're laughing at right there.
No, I just got back from a film festival, all right? Oh. It's just like every time the thank yous happen, all right, it's like, okay.
Yeah.
But we did a little teaser for the very end to make people stay, so. So in about 10 minutes, it'll come up when the credits are done.
All our generous product placement here. This next soundtrack on Lakeshore Records.
Yes, it's a really eclectic and great soundtrack.
It's a terrific soundtrack.
This next thing almost gave our DP Matt Irving a heart attack, but it was hilarious.
Was note to self: any directors out there working with Johnny Knoxville in the future, don't whisper chaos in his ear as a direction, and then you'll see it the last.
We had a few minutes right before we lost our light, and we were just telling them to have fun. But then, yes, Katrina said chaos. Not a good idea.
This was it. Tap him on the shoulder. That's what you got. And then you have to go make peace with your DP.
Thanks for watching.
Thank you for watching our movie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.